All right, so it's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank the organizers for the invitation to come to Vancouver. In the middle of the summer, leaving Arizona is kind of a critical thing. So what I'd like to talk about today is something which starts out being physics and ends up being number theory, which you'll see. And in particular, I'd like to talk about the distinction between shape and volume. Most people talk about large extra dimensions, they mean large volumes. People don't have, in the phenomenology community, pay too much attention to the influence of shape. And so what I'd like to do is actually focus on shape for this talk. So first I'll talk about why one might want to consider shape, and in particular there are going to be two reasons. The first is that shape affects the Kaluza-Klein spectrum. In rather dramatic ways, it induces level crossing and a various mass gap. It can help to eliminate light Kaluza-Klein states. Turns out it'll even alter experimental constraints. In particular, it'll remove completely the bound on the size of the largest possible extra dimension that could exist. And so what that means is that large extra dimensions can essentially be invisible, and I'll talk about this. This is work that came out, last August, and it's in PRL. And then the second reason one should consider shape is that shape will cast what I'll call shadows. In particular, I'll show that the Planck scale physics will cast shadows over low energy physics. And in particular, the shape moduli associated with Planck scale extra dimensions can distort the way you would perceive larger extra dimensions, such as millimeters or TeVs. So it'll distort the way you see compactification geometry at all scales. And this is rather unusual and a little bit counterintuitive. And one way of phrasing this is that what this means is that compactification geometry itself is essentially renormalized or changes as a function of the energy scale at which you probe it. And so this is work that came out also, and it's since in PRL as well. And then I'll conclude with some other extensions of these ideas. So to begin with, before we talk about shape, I guess the natural question is why one should talk about extra dimensions to begin with. But of course, at a conference like this, we all know that extra dimensions are really required in fundamental theories. Almost every fundamental theory that we know of involves extra dimensions. If they're large, that means that they can have important phenomenological effects. They can lower the Planck scale. They can lower the gut scale. They can lower the string scale. They can be used to warp the geometry and thereby localize gravity and have an alternative to compactification. And so because of these features, they provide new mechanisms for all sorts of problems. Gauge hierarchy, electroweak symmetry, breaking fermion masses, neutrino. Almost everything you do beyond the standard model can now be done again or thought about again in the context of extra dimensions. And so the possibility of large extra dimensions provides a new perspective, really, on all of physics beyond the standard model. And this new perspective could, if the dimensions are large enough, actually be tested in upcoming collider experiments, which is why this is exciting. But if you think about it, the degree to which these fundamental scales of physics can be lowered depends on the total volume of the extra compactified dimensions. Through a relation, for example, in the ADD case, the relation between the four-dimensional Planck scale and the higher-dimensional fundamental scale is related by the volume. So large Planck scale is generated from a small higher-dimensional scale by a big volume. So large extra dimensions really means large compactification volume. But in truth, compactification manifolds are described not just by volume moduli, which are more generally called Kähler moduli, but also by shape moduli, which are complex moduli. So the question is, what are not just the phenomenological implications of the Kähler moduli, but what are the phenomenological implications of the complex moduli, the shape moduli? And this question is very important because the shape moduli play a significant role in determining the experimental bounds on these scenarios. For example, as we'll see, they can dramatically affect the Kaluza-Klein spectra that are associated with these extra dimensions. And unfortunately, in most discussions that appear in the literature, people ignore these shape moduli completely. And so I think it's important to look at them and see what kinds of phenomenological benefits or possibilities they provide. And as I said, the things that we're going to find are that most of our usual expectations no longer apply. Large extra dimensions can be invisible, even if they're flat, so we're not talking about warping here. The experimental constraints can be loosened by arbitrary amounts, and the compactification geometry, as I said, is just renormalized, like other constants of nature. Radius of compactification is like electron charge in this sense. Both are things that really get renormalized. And we don't need anything very complicated to see this. So in this talk, I'm going to be looking only at extra dimensions that are flat. I'll be only looking at toroidal compactifications, the very simplest things. And I only need to consider one, two, or three extra dimensions. So circle, two torus, and three torus. And that's it. And all of these ideas will be able to be illustrated just from these basic simple settings. So let me start by just considering a very simple two torus. And we know what a two torus is. We take R2, the plane, and we mod out by a lattice, governed by two lattice vectors, if you will. So this is the torus. We identify this side with this side. That makes a cylinder. We identify that side with that side. That makes a flat torus. So there are two identifications. The first one that we're identifying is y1, the coordinate, y1 and y2 are the coordinates of the extra two dimensions in this case. So the first periodicity is y1 goes to y1 plus 2 pi r1. And y2 stays constant. So this is the radius in the first direction. This is the radius in the second direction. And the interesting thing that you are seeing relative to the usual case is the presence of this angle theta. Really, there is a possible angle between these two. These are different lattices, and therefore they are different tori. And so a torus, in this sense, is specified by three real parameters, not just two. R1, R2, and a shift angle. The angle that governs the relative directions, the angle between the two directions of the two periodicities. Now, I should stress that you may think at first that this theta doesn't mean anything, but it does. Tori with different theta are conformally inequivalent. I know it says topologically distinct. I mean that really in the sense of conformally inequivalent. They're both tori, certainly. They're all tori with different thetas, but they're conformally inequivalent up to modular transformations, which I'll discuss at the end. For all theta, the metric is flat. This is still R2, so we're not introducing curvature or warping or anything like that. The volume of such a torus is simply the volume of this parallelogram, 2 pi R1 times 2 pi R2 times sine theta. That's this. The other two descriptions, the other two parameters, can be folded into shape. R2 over R1, which is a kind of trivial shape, how narrow and long versus how wide and thick. But the other one is theta. And sometimes in the string literature, and even here, we'll talk sometimes about tau as the complex parameter, which is just this ratio times e to the I theta. So most previous studies of extra dimensions have focused on the effects of having a large volume. And some of them even talk about the ratio of R1 over R2, although I'm not really going to be interested in that. That's a kind of trivial shape. But what they've done is they've essentially fixed this angle, theta, to be pi over 2, 90 degrees, where the two periodicity directions of the torus are orthogonal. So what I'd like to ask is, what are the phenomenological implications of having a non-trivial theta? Non-trivial means not 90 degrees, not rectangular. Well, the first thing, obviously, that you have to do is analyze the Kaluza-Klein wave functions on this space. So you play the same game as usual. You have to first demand that the wave functions be invariant under the torus periodicities. So that means that instead of just having plane waves, e to the I n1 over r1, n2 over r2, the effect of this non-trivial theta is to introduce some mixing, which you see here, the y1 minus y2. So if you take theta be 90 degrees, you get back the usual case. E to the I n1 over r1 plus n2 over r2, y1, y2. Then you want to know the mass of this corresponding state, so you apply the mass operator, which is the curvature, and you get the corresponding formula for the masses. So there it is. It's what you would have expected, n1 squared over r1 squared plus n2 over r2 squared, but there's a mixing term which is proportional to cosine theta, so it vanishes if theta is 90 degrees, and then there's an overall normalization factor, 1 over sine squared theta. And that's it. So right away, if you had thought that theta was not a physical parameter, you see that it is, because it affects something actually physical and measurable, the masses of the corresponding Kaluza-Klein states. Well, the presence of non-trivial theta does a number of things. It shows that the mass spectrum is no longer invariant under n1 goes to minus n1, flipping in the direction of the fifth dimension for the momentum, nor is it invariant under n2 goes to minus n2, which is flipping of the momentum of the sixth dimension. It is, however, invariant under a combined flip, n1, n2 goes to minus 1, n1 minus n2. It is invariant under n1 goes to minus n1 or n2 goes to minus n2 individually if you combine it with a theta goes to minus pi minus theta, or in other words, if you change the sine of cosine theta. So that means that you can restrict your attention. In general, theta goes from 0 to pi over 2. You can restrict your attention from 0 to pi, so you can restrict it to 0 to pi over 2. So we'll always be considering theta from 90 degrees, and then we're going to ask what happens as I collapse that torus and take theta down to 0. There is indeed. Everything is modular invariant. This is modular invariant. So if I apply modular transformations on this spectrum, I can tell you exactly what happens. We won't need it until later. But if I do a modular transformation, N1 goes to, well, if I take tau goes to tau plus 1, that corresponds to keeping N1 fixed, changing N2 by, N2 goes to N2 minus N1, and theta gets changed accordingly in the radii. And likewise, tau goes to minus 1 over tau, exchanges R1 and R2, and exchanges N1 to N2, and N2 to minus N1. So there is modular invariance lurking everywhere here, but I'm not going to need it. Okay?
And the T-duality
is T-duality is only going to be relevant for me at the very end of the talk. I'm going to be assuming, well, first of all, T-duality is irrelevant if I don't have a string scale. And I'm not asking anything about string theory here. But if there's a string scale, then there is a scale for string theory, a scale for these KK modes, and a scale for winding modes. And then there is a T-duality there. But, you know, these are dual to winding modes, and I'm not talking about winding modes. In fact, at this moment, I'm not even talking about strings. Yeah. It doesn't affect it. It's part of it. Yeah, the whole set of duality symmetries critically involve theta. They involve Beam-Yonu fields. They're very complicated. Well, they're not complicated, but they're yes, it's involved. So you could not do the whole picture if you didn't involve non-trivial shape. So, but the important thing, I think, to notice from here is just the simple observation that the Kaluza-Klein spectrum depends on theta in a non-trivial level-dependent way. It clearly comes in, and it depends on how much it gets multiplied by N1 and N2, so different KK levels are going to do different things. So already you see something interesting could be occurring. So let's just get our feet wet by considering the simplest case of R1 equals R2 equals R. Rectangular, well, we'll start with rectangular, but square lattice. We're not going to worry about changing any ratios of sides. Well, what that means then is that N1 and N2 can be exchanged with each other, and that means that we have a four-fold degeneracy. However, if N1 equals N2, then we states only have two-fold degeneracies. And as you vary theta, you can find what happens to the mass levels. So let me talk about this now very quickly. So I'm always going to plot things as sine theta goes from 1, which means rectangular, down to 0, which means collapsed. So I'm always going to plot my tori falling that way. So the usual spectra are the ones that you expect at theta equals 90 degrees, where sine theta is 1. So when R1 equals R2, the KK spectrum is 1, that's the state 1, 0. Then there's a mass at root 2, which is the 1 minus 1 states, or the minus 1, 1 states. I'm not plotting these degeneracies. Remember, each of these lines are degenerate according to here. Then there's states at 2, for example, the 2, 0 states and the 0, 2 states, and so forth, root 6, and so forth as you work your way up. So this is the spectrum of KK states that you would have found for the square torus, nothing spectacular. But as I collapse this torus, this is what happens to the states. And you see that there's a lot of stuff happening here. There are several things to notice right away. First, the ground state, the zero mode, remains massless. There's a mode here, it stays zero. Obviously, in that mass formula, if all the ends are zero, then you stay zero. In other words, there is a unique vacuum which stays. There's no vacuum energy shift. The first thing to notice, though, is that the identity of the first excited state is a function of theta. Up to here, it's this state, the 1, 0. Out to here, it's a different state entirely. There's been a level crossing. And in particular, this line, remember, represents four states. 1, 0, minus 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, minus 1. Whereas out here, this represents two states, 1, 1, and minus 1, minus 1. So what's happening is that the number of states at the first excited level is 4 here, but 2 here. This will be important in a minute. Also notice that the majority of the KK states become infinitely heavy as theta collapses, as the torus collapses. And I remind you, this is happening even though the radii are being held fixed. We're just varying theta. Notice most of the states get infinitely heavy. Only some of them, wind up getting or remaining finitely massive. And those are the states where KK, where the two numbers are equal, N1 and N2, and those are the only ones that survive as theta goes to zero.
Are these just the one-dimensional
states? Those are the one-dimensional states. I'll come back to those in a minute. I will do that also. That's coming. Right now, I'm going through fixing the radius, not the volume, because I want to get our feet wet first with radius, because the volume case is a lot more complicated, and before we can understand that, we have to understand what happens here.
Then it's not surprising.
I know. That's right. It isn't. And you'll see exactly what happens when the volume is held fixed. I'll show you that soon. Okay? Other questions?
Yeah. If you let N1 not even answer and let theta go to zero, everything goes to infinity.
Yeah. The only states which survive are...
Why don't you collapse to a one-dimensional state? It's kind
of... You do. I'm going to explain. This is going to be obvious to you in about 1 minute. Okay. So, the big things to notice from that plot are that the mass gap, mu, between the zero state and the first excited state, and the degeneracy, how many of first excited states are there, both of these properties are themselves functions of theta. Why is this important? Well, think about what would happen if we're talking about gravitons. If we're talking about gravitons where the extra dimensions are transverse to the brain that contains the standard model fields, then KK gravitons in the usual way induce deviations from Newtonian gravity. You don't just have GMM over R from the zero mode, but you also have a contribution from the first excited modes, the second excited modes, and so forth. Each of these modes gives a contribution which is multiplied by the number, the degeneracy of those modes, but suppressed by the mass gap, by their mass of those modes. Precision tests of non-Newtonian gravity are looking for these deviations. And so what happens is that if, as you change theta, you're changing the degeneracy of states at the first excited level, you're changing alpha. And so if the number of first excited states drops from 4 to 0, 4 to 2, as we saw, then the size of the deviations from Newtonian gravity drop by a factor of 2 as you close that torus, which means that you're much harder to see because you're dropping at least by an overall factor. Later, when we change the mass gap, we'll actually drop by exponential amounts. This is also important even if the extra dimensions are in the brain. In that case, we're talking about Kaluza-Klein excitations of standard model fields. Once again, the most precise bounds on these kinds of longitudinal extra dimensions come from effective Fermi interactions that would be induced by, for example, exchanges of the Kaluza-Klein gauge bosons. And these will also be suppressed in colliders according to alphas and mus. So that's why it's important to know how many states are there at the first excited level and what are the mass gaps. Okay, what happens as theta goes to zero? Harry was asking this question. Well, as theta goes to zero, the two cycles of the torus are collapsing on top of each other. And so the resulting KK spectrum depends on whether the two periodicities of this torus, the two cycles, are commensurate with each other. If R1 equals R2, as we had in that example, then the cycles are commensurate. The torus periodicities collapse to become the single periodicity of a circle of that radius, R1, R2, or R. In which case, the light KK states that survived are nothing but the states that we would have had for compactification on a circle. And indeed, if you look back at that plot, that's what we saw. This was a torus, this is a circle. 1 over R, 2 over R, 3 over R, and so forth. So this makes complete sense. What's happening here is that we're really interpolating between a two torus and a 1 torus by collapsing theta. So the shape angle theta allows us to smoothly interpolate between compactifications with different numbers of space-time dimensions. So that's cute. And in fact, a similar behavior occurs whenever R1 over R2 is rational. Because as theta goes to zero, you can take that mass formula and Taylor expand around theta. As theta goes to zero, here's a leading term which is a divergence. Then there's a term which is a constant, and then terms which are suppressed. So you look at what happens. Clearly, if R1 over R2 have a rational ratio, then there exist values of N1 over N2 for which you can cancel the first term, kill the tendency to diverge. You're then just left with constants, and that's what happens. And specifically, if R2 over R1 is irrational, let me write it as P over Q, then the states K times PQ, for all values of K, are ones for which this first term vanishes, so they can stay light even as theta goes to zero, and they become the KK states for the circle that results when you collapse the torus, and the radius of the circle is R1 over Q, or equivalently R2 over P, so it all hangs together.
It's smaller.
And note that generally R1 is less, yes, smaller, than R1 or R2, which means that the mass gap generally increases as theta goes to zero, even though you're left behind with a circle. For example, here's what happens when R1 equals 4 R2. Here's what happens when the ratio is 4. As you collapse, everything gets heavy except the ones that would be circle compactified states. They come light. There's the first one. The second one would be four, twice as high, and so forth. The mass gap has now gone up by a factor of 4. Mass gap getting large by a factor of 4 means that I have an exponential suppression of the deviations from non-Newtonian gravity. So in these Cavendish experiments that people do to look for these things, this would be exponentially suppressed compared to here, even though the radii are being held fixed, not the volume, but the radii. Okay? So, obviously, that's what happens when R1 over R2 is rational. So now I have to ask what happens when R1 over R2 is irrational, because I expect on general grounds that the irrationals are much more numerous than the rationals. So that's the general thing. Well, in that case, the torus periodicities are incommensurate. As you close the torus, these two periodic conditions become incompatible. The incompatibility of these two periodicity conditions becomes increasingly severe as theta goes to zero. Effectively, if you think about it, you write it as a rational P and Q. P and Q are going to infinity. So the effective circle, which is R1 over P or R2 over Q, is going to zero. These are all different ways of saying that all of the KK states become infinitely heavy as theta goes to zero. No light states left when it's irrational. Now, of course, the actual limit, theta goes to zero, is singular. And I'm not really interested in that. The point is that if R2 over R1 is irrational, I can make my excited KK states arbitrarily heavy, as much as I need for phenomenological purposes, simply by choosing a sufficiently small value of theta. And this happens even though the radii are being held fixed. Okay? And I'll talk about dynamically why I expect that maybe I would flow to very small theta in a few minutes. So the point is that such extra dimensions in this scenario would therefore be essentially invisible with respect to all laboratory or observational constraints that rely on the presence of light Kaluza-Klein states. And if you think about it, that includes a lot. Tabletop Cavendish experiments, light bulk neutrinos or axions, stellar cooling constraints, supernova constraints, four Fermi interactions of standard model fields, collider KK production, everything. Okay? So that's the first part. That's what happens when the radii are held fixed. So let me just summarize. So thus far, we've held the radii fixed. If R2 over R1 is rational, most states become heavy, but the ones that become the circle compactified states, stay light. If R2 over R1 is irrational, all the KK states become infinitely heavy. There is no circle generated as theta goes to zero, or equivalently, the radius of that effective circle is zero. However, as was pointed out, even though the radii are held fixed, the volume of the extra dimensions is still falling to zero as theta goes to zero. So you might ask, to what extent can the compactification volume remain large while the KK states become heavy? In general, what is the role of the shape moduli when the volume is held fixed? So now we want to repeat that story, but we want to hold the volume fixed. Sure.
You can imagine there's some mechanism where theta is almost fixed, but oscillates a little bit.
Oscillates.
And you've got a chaotic thing.
Well, I don't know if it's mathematically chaotic, but
irrational, somebody jumps the infinity.
Oh, you mean as I pass through rationals and irrationals?
Yeah.
You know what happens? It's very weird. You probably want to know. As I move from rationals to irrationals, why should the KK spectrum jump around like this? It's not. It's smooth. What's happening is that a state which was going to become light, at the very last minute, if I'm irrational, it turns up and goes heavy again. And you'll see this coming now. Okay? Everything is smooth, even though it does depend mathematically on rationals versus irrationals. Okay. So, if we want to hold the volume fixed, we need to examine the behavior when we do hold the volume fixed. The volume, remember, is 2 pi r1, 2 pi r2 times sine theta. So let's pull out the volume from the overall mass formula and write it this way. So now here's the volume times the mass. I've pulled it out. So everything left over here is purely shape. Indeed, it just depends on the shape angle theta and the ratios of radii, R1 over R2 and R2 over R1. So this is just shape. These are now dimensionless numbers. So I'm going to keep the volume fixed from now on. I'm going to keep the ratios R1 over R2 fixed. And I'll just examine how things depend on theta. Okay? Now remember my definition. Tau is R2 over R1 e to the I theta. I think I may later change notation. So tau modulus is just R2 over R1. Okay? So that's mod tau. That's inverse mod tau. In case I change notation, which I will. Okay. Now think about what this means before we even start to look at the formula. Keeping the volume and the ratios fixed means that as I collapse the torus, as that volume would have shrunk to zero, I've got to compensate by shooting the radii out bigger and bigger and bigger in direct proportion to sine theta, such that as I collapse it, the angle is getting smaller, but the radii are getting bigger and bigger, and the volume, therefore, is being kept constant. Because of the fact the radii are growing larger and larger to compensate for the fact that the torus is collapsing, what this means is that there's an extra tendency relative to the previous case toward having lighter Kaluza-Klein states, because as I'm collapsing the theta, I'm now making the radii bigger and bigger. So there's an extra tendency now to fight against the states which were getting heavy and try to pull them back down. And there's this tension that we're going to have to handle very carefully, and that's what we'll be doing. So first, what happens if the ratio is rational? Well, if it's rational, here's the case with R1 equals R2. Here's the case with R1 equals 4R2. Same cases as before. Before, remember, we had the states that came in, and they looked like the circle. Well, now, this extra tendency toward making them light means that these states all become massless. So the states that become massless here are the former states that used to be the circles in the rational case. Likewise here, there was a state at 4, and then another one at 8, and so forth. Well, here they are, and there's an infinite tower of them all coming massless again, because those are the ones that used to be the circle, compactified states. Yeah?
But there isn't any that came down and became finite.
There had been. In the case when the radii were held fixed, but not the volume.
Yeah, no, here.
No, none. That's right. The ones that were all finite are now getting all pulled to zero because I've extracted a sine theta from them to make the volume.
The infinite ones did not become, none of them became finite.
That is correct.
Yeah, but you're
No, this
holding n fixed to that theta goes to zero.
I am holding. What is n?
Excitation level.
No. I'm plotting this curve for every value of n.
Exactly.
Yes, every value.
Sure. Limit.
Wait. We're coming to that. But there's nothing misleading here. I'm giving you the full truth.
Okay?
The states which would have been circles all get massless. All the other states continue up to infinity. Okay? All right. Now, is this interesting? Yes, still. Because the mass gap, you notice, can still increase as theta decreases. For example, here, the mass gap has gone from 1 up to 2. All right. And that is technically an exponential suppression of the effects that would deviate from Newtonian gravity, even though the volume and the ratio of the Planck scales is now being held fixed. So think about this. We are holding the volume fixed, and therefore we're holding the ratio of Planck scales fixed. But still, we're increasing the mass gap by a factor of 2, which means we are exponentially suppressing the deviations from gravity for these Cavendish experiments. Okay. But you see that I can't get much out of this. This is not a big effect, because ultimately, although I was starting to increase the mass gap here, I hit these circle compactified states, which end up coming light again. So the thing that I'd really like to do is get rid of these massless KK states that emerge as theta goes to zero. In other words, I want to get rid of the pileup of these states down here. And how can I avoid those states? Well, it's quite obvious. If those used to be the states that were the circle, and I didn't have them when the circle wasn't a circle, in other words, when I had an irrational ratio, what happens now when I have an irrational ratio? That's my only chance. So, we're heading toward number theory. Here it comes. But it's actually quite nice. I mean, I actually went, for the first time, I went over to my math department, knocked on doors. Those guys know a lot. They knew the answer right away. Okay, so the question is, does irrationality of the ratio prevent those massless states? Well, there are two opposite forces at play. This is called buildup. There are two opposite forces at play in such cases. There's the tendency toward masslessness as theta goes to zero due to the expanding radii, but then there's a tendency towards having infinite masses due to the fact that the relative irrationality as the theta closes, due to the incommensurate periodicities as the torus collapses. And the interplay here is actually very subtle. So let's do it carefully. So what we want to do is examine the limit of the fixed volume masses, the previous formula where I pull out the volume, as theta goes to zero. So here's what I have now, same as I had before, except that I pulled out the volume, so I'm holding the volume fixed. So there's a term that diverges linearly with theta. The next term is proportional to theta, and then higher powers of theta. And now I'm using the notation mod tau is just R2 over R1. Okay? So, you say, okay, even though the ratio of radii, mod tau, is irrational, I can find a sequence of states, N1, N2, such that N2 is approximately N1 tau. In other words, I can almost make this cancel as close as I want, as accurately as I want. I can always approximate any irrational by a rational as close as I wish if I'm willing to allow N1 and N2 to be bigger and bigger. So I can drive this to zero, thereby saving me from the divergence. But I do that at the cost of using bigger values of N1 and N2. And when I use bigger and bigger values of N1 and N2, I drive this term up. There's a balancing. This is the fighting between the tendency toward masslessness and the tendency toward divergence. So the question then is, how quickly or with what efficiency can I make a ratio of rational numbers approach an irrational number as a function of those rational numbers? In other words, if I take pi as my irrational number, if I want to get a cancellation of 17 digits to pi, how big must N1 and N2 be such that the ratio is pi? And does that depend on the value pi? What if I chose e? What if I chose the square root of 5 or the golden mean? So that's the question now. It's a number theory, purely number theory question. Given an irrational number, how efficiently can I get a lot of cancellations there in the numerator for relatively small values of n1 and n2? Okay, so you go to the math department, and they say math 300 and something. So it's only a junior level course. It depends on the irrational number you're talking about. This is R2 over R1. In general, you can parameterize the cancellation rate. So this is just a parameterization. The difference, this is R2 over R1, the difference drops like N1, some power of N1, so the higher N1 and N2 are, don't forget, N2 is just going to be tau times N1 effectively. So this cancellation drops. If I have bigger N1s, I cancel more and more terms here, as you expect, with some power. Gamma is some unknown number, which is going to describe how well I can approximate. And there's some overall numerical constant on top, A. Okay? For some gamma and A. Gamma in the mathematical literature is called the irrationality measure. So different numbers are more irrational than others, depending on their values of gamma. And if you just write this as the form for the cancellation, this is what happens to the mass formula. So I'm just taking that N2 minus N1 squared, putting it in, I find this. So where y, this is the first term, the second term, where y is some combination of stuff left over. Okay? So if gamma is positive, in other words, if it really cancels well, then if gamma is positive, what happens is that this becomes more and more massless as n1 goes, as I choose n1s and n2s that go big. If gamma is zero or negative, then I avoid massless states. But it depends on what the values of A and gamma are for various irrational numbers. So, now we've got the math problem posed. What's the value of gamma? There's a branch of mathematics which deals with this called Diophantine approximation. And this is a question of Diophantine approximation. And the answer is Dirichlet, 1842. So I have gotten now D something into this talk. No brains, but instead just Dirichlet himself. 1842. If tau is transcendental, I have to remind you, irrationals can be separated into algebraic irrationals and transcendentals. Algebraics are the roots of polynomial equations which have integer coefficients, like root 5 or something. Transcendentals are e's and pi's, things that don't. If tau is transcendental, Dirichlet already proved that gamma is always positive. It was a very simple argument. It's called the mailbox argument. It's just how many envelopes you can shove into different mailboxes and so forth. Anyway, it's a very simple proof. So, gamma is positive. That means that massless states appear as theta goes to zero for any transcendental irrational ratio. So in other words, you can't avoid the massless states if your ratio is pi or e. Those are the numbers that are the best to approximate. You can do it really well. The ones that are sticky are the algebraics, and nobody knew the answer for them until 1955, when a mathematician named Roth proved that if algebraic, then gamma equals zero. Huh. So that means that you don't get massless states as theta goes to zero for algebraic irrational numbers. You just don't. And that means that if gamma equals zero, you put it back into this formula, you find that the KK masses satisfy a lower bound, 2 times A, because y plus 1 over y is best 2. That's the minimum value for this. It depends on the angle theta, but for any theta, you choose an n1 such that y is approximately 1. And so for different values of theta, there's a different lightest state at any moment. It's the lightest state for, as theta goes to 0, it's the one for which y becomes approximately 1. And for that state, this is 2, this is 0, so you just have 2a. So you prove rigorously a lower bound. The mass gap is...
about a?
Huh? Yes, of course, mathematicians have thought it all through. I'm coming to that. But let's first talk about this. So the mass gap is bounded from below as theta goes to 0. For example, here is a plot with 1 plus the golden mean. And I'll motivate why this number is an interesting ratio in a minute. Because I want to focus as theta goes to 0, I'm taking log of sine. So this is sine is 1. This is 10th, 100th, 1,000th. Okay, we're really zooming in now on that theta goes to 0 limit. Here's a state. It got heavy. Now notice, this is approximately 1.6. So the state 1, 2 is the first good approximation toward a cancellation. It's getting light, but then it turns around and goes heavy again. Remember, nothing can stay light, or nothing can stay massless. 1.3 is the next state, which is a better approximation with this ratio, but ultimately it too fails, because it's an irrational thing it's trying to approximate. As you get closer to theta, 2, 5 is even better as an approximation. It comes, it fails. So then 3.8 is doing an even better job. Notice we're not down to 0.01 for the sine. It comes down, it goes up. 5.13, better. Okay, notice the Fibonacci sequence developing. Number theory. Okay, so the lightest states are these. 2 separated in the Fibonacci series. But you see that there's eventually, asymptotically, a lowest mass gap, which is the one we found, which is given by that value of A. In this case, that value of A turns out to be something, and you can calculate it, so it's 2.34, and there it is. Okay? So the mass gap indeed rises by a factor of 2.34 for this example, for this value of tau, as theta goes to zero. Okay. Now, let's think about this. For a general algebraic irrational value of tau, the mass gap, what was it at zero? I mean, for a rectangular, for 90 degrees, it was 1 over tau. Let's assume tau is bigger than 1. So it's 1 over tau is the mass gap when it's 90 degrees. When I collapse it, we saw that it's 2a, independent of tau. This is very important. So as theta goes to zero, the mass gap relative to what you had at 90 degrees versus what you have at zero increases by a ratio 2 times A times tau. So now the question is, what is the value of A? For any tau, what is the value of A? So you walk back to the math department, and they tell you once again it is due to Diophantus. Well, it's Diophantine geometry, and here's what is known. The set of all possible values of A for all irrational numbers is discrete, and it has a maximum value, which is 1 over root 5. A is a series of numbers. It's called the Lagrange spectrum. And the biggest value is 1 over root 5. I don't know how the mathematicians do these things, but it's great. Moreover, the values of tau can be sorted into equivalence classes where each member of that class shares a common value of A. So here's a value of A, and here are all the irrationals, infinitely many, that have that value of A. Here's another value of A, smaller than 1 over root 5, and it has a whole series of irrationals associated with it, and so forth. Moreover, the set of tau in each equivalence class is infinite and contains tau of arbitrarily large magnitude. Beautiful. What does that mean in physics? Implications. Mass gap as theta goes to 0 never exceeds 1 over root 5 for any tau. Nevertheless, you can choose large values of tau such that 2a times tau, the increase, the ratio of mass gaps goes to infinity. So, depending on the value of tau that you choose, the mass gap ratio can be chosen to be arbitrarily large. You can gain an arbitrary amount of stuff by having theta go to 0 for these scenarios. The ratio of mass gaps is infinitely large. Why is this important? Well, let's think about it. Let's talk about the experimental bounds on extra dimensions. I'll assume tau is bigger than 1 for simplicity. Let's first consider what happens when theta is 90 degrees. When theta is 90 degrees, the mass gap is 1 over tau. That's what all these curves start at, as theta is 90 degrees. The experimental bound, however, says that the minimum value of the mass gap is bigger than some experimental number, millimeter, whatever Adelberger tells you from his experiments, Cavendish experiments, or whatever the collider people tell you if we're talking about in the brain extra dimensions. So this is a minimum value for the lightest KK mode. So put this inequality into here, you wind up with a bound. On the volume times tau, tau, remember, is the ratio. That's what's bounded, bigger, less than some experimental limit. Well, tau is R2 over R1. Multiply that in with the volume, which is R2 times R1, you get a bound on R2, which is what we assume to be the largest extra dimension. So what is bounded in the normal scenario with theta equals pi over 2 is not the volume, but it is the size of the largest single extra dimension, which is what you expect. If a single extra dimension got too big, you would have too light a Kaluza-Klein state, and there's the bound. Let's compare this with what happens as theta goes to 0. As theta goes to 0, the mass gap in that limit is bounded by a number A, which is not related to tau, the ratio. That's the whole point. So when the minimum experimental bound is bigger than something here, we now put that in and get a bound directly on the volume. We don't get a bound on any volume times tau, because there's no tau here. So we just get a bound on the volume. Or remembering that the volume is given, or multiplying both sides of this equation by tau anyway, we find that R2 squared is bounded by an amount which I can send to infinity. Because 2a times tau I can make arbitrarily large, sine theta is going to 0, this goes to infinity. So I have a bound on the volume, but not on the size of the largest single extra dimension. So the constraints become infinitely weaker as theta goes to 0, even though I'm holding the volume fixed. The bound on the largest extra dimension becomes a bound directly on the volume independent of the radii. Normally, you'd say, I keep the radius fixed. I can only, you know, I can make one dimension big, one small, one big. Either way, I can't push it too far because I'm going to hit millimeters. I'm going to hit TeVs. Now, when it's closing, I have the freedom to do anything I want, a mile long, flat extra dimensions, because the bound, as I go to 0, is not dependent on that ratio. All right. Is this natural? Nobody asked. I need R2 over R1 to be irrational, and I need to take theta goes to 0. Is this natural? Well, let's recall something. The KK spectrum is invariant under modular transformations. This was pointed out earlier. Here they are. Therefore, modular invariance is a symmetry here. It should be a symmetry of any dynamical effective potential which arises somehow, which eventually stabilizes the moduli. There should be some parameter tau, which is, governs the shape, and there should be some effective potential, which I'll assume to be modular invariant. That's the symmetry of the torus. If so, if modular invariance governs that spectrum, that means that the extrema of the potential, whatever they are, should correspond to the fixed points under modular transformations. This has been used in a lot of contexts. Eric and Eduardo Pontan used this when talking about Casimir energies. This is a standard result. So now you just ask, where are the modular fixed points? Well, for theta being bigger than 0, there are only two distinct fixed points, tau equals I and tau equals I pi over 3. But if we consider the limit as theta goes to 0, you can find a whole series of additional fixed points. This is in the collapsing torus limit. You're approaching these fixed points. Here they are. Because for these points, tau goes to minus 1 over tau is equivalent to tau goes to tau plus p, where p is some integer. So and that's identified with tau itself, and so that's a fixed point. Well, these are fixed points. Notice when p equals 3, I get 1 half 3 plus root 5, which is the 1 plus the golden mean, which is the example I chose before. And for all p bigger than or equal to 2, these values are all algebraic irrational numbers, and the limit is theta goes to 0. Thus, I claim it's possible, at least, that the dynamics might choose the shape moduli to approach these fixed points given appropriate initial conditions. And as such, these limiting cases could emerge as the result of some non-perturbative string dynamics or through cosmological evolution, time-dependent cosmology, who knows. Okay? That's the... I can't say that it's stable. I don't know. We have to know the potential. But at least you know that there's some niceness. There's a tendency, perhaps, to flow that way. Maybe there's a tendency to flow away from it, but yeah.
Are these things somehow related to the subgroups of the moduli?
Of course. Everything's related. yes. Well, yeah, sure. You mean like gamma naught 2 and so forth, all the Atkin-Lehner subgroups? Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Okay, I have a final thing which will take me exactly 15 minutes. Let's change topics completely. Well, not completely, but almost completely. I want to talk about the second paper. Even more interesting, maybe. It's this business about Planck scale shadowing lower energy physics. What? Again, if the light is taking... Remember, I'm never sending the lightest mass gap to infinity. I'm not doing that. It's the ratio which is going to infinity. I'm never sending the lightest KK mode to infinity. As long as I don't do that, the winding states are still very, very high. Or another way to say it is I haven't specified a string scale. In fact, I will talk about winding modes in my very last transparency, so I'll come back to this. That's the third paper. All right, let me just get to this, because this is a whole different thing, but perhaps also as interesting. By the way, I should say, all this work is in collaboration with Arash Mafi, who's my postdoc in Arizona. All right. Once again, shape versus volume. But now we'll notice something different. Volume moduli are dimensionful. Volume. They necessarily have an energy scale associated with them. But shape moduli are dimensionless. Ratios of radii, angles. So what that means is that even as the radii and volumes associated with certain extra dimensions are taken to zero, some extra dimensions are Planck scale, they disappear, the corresponding shape moduli for them don't vanish. They don't go away when the volumes go away. They're like the smile on the Cheshire Cat. They stay even though the volumes disappear. And what they can do as they remain behind is trigger what I call a shadowing phenomenon, whereby Planck scale extra dimensions can significantly distort the perception of compactification geometry associated with big extra dimensions. So suppose some extra dimensions are millimeters or TeVs and others are Planck scale. I'm claiming that the Planck scale ones will change the way you perceive the millimeters. And that's very unusual. So let's again illustrate this very simply by considering 1, 2, and 3-dimensional tori. Here they are. The one torus is a line interval. I'm going to call the radius rho. Rho is always going to mean one extra dimension. Here's my old torus again, but now I'm going to call it small r1, small r2, because little r's are going to mean two tori, 2-dimensional tori. There's the angle theta. For a 3-torus, it's a parallelogram. I'm going to use capital R1, R2, R3 for that. And the angles I'm going to call alpha. So alpha 1, 3 is the angle between direction 1 and direction 3. Alpha 1, 2 between 1 and 2. Alpha 2, 3 between 2 and 3, and so forth. Okay, so the angles are called alphas for the 3-torus, theta for the 2-torus. The radii are called capital R for the 3-torus, little r for the 2-torus, rho for the 1-torus, which is the line. Okay, let's now imagine that the real world is compactified on that 3-torus. And let's imagine that there's a huge hierarchy of length scales. R3 is really, really tiny. The height is Planck scale. Likewise, R2, the depth into the blackboard, is 10 to the 11 TeV, something intermediate. R1, the big front of the torus, is millimeter, or TeV, something huge, okay? So let's imagine now, how would observers at different energies perceive this manifold experimentally? If your energy is big enough, bigger than the highest at the Planck scale, you will see three dimensions worth of Kalutza Klein excitations, you will see the full three torus, no problem. You can fit and you can find R1, R2, R3, alpha, alpha, alpha. Suppose your energy is between 10 to the 11 and 10 to the 19. You do not have enough energy to see, to resolve, that little perpendicular height coming up that Planck scale. All you're going to see is the base, the two large dimensions of the torus. You will claim it's a two torus. Okay, fine. If your energy is even lower, you will only see the biggest, the front, the largest extra dimension. You'll say, okay, it's a circle. Moreover, given this hierarchy, everything should decouple from everything else, and what you would expect is that if you saw the two torus, you'd say the front height, the front length, is just whatever R1 was. After all, this is just the front edge of this, so R1 should equal R1. R2, the depth is just the depth, so it should be R2. The angle on the base, this is the base, alpha 1, 2 should just be that angle theta. Moreover, if you could only have enough energy to see the circle, you'd say that rho, the angle for the circle, the length of the circle, is just R1, the long dimension of the base, which is nothing but R1, the front of the whole parallelogram. Right? Wrong. The point here is that these correspondence relations are completely wrong, even in the presence of an infinitely large hierarchy. That Planck scale is going to zero. Doesn't matter. Indeed, these relations, the ones I showed, would only hold when the shape moduli are actually 90 degrees, rectangular. However, if you're dealing with a non-rectangular torus, those relations completely fail to describe the process by which you integrate out extra small dimensions when you pass to larger and larger length scales. And this failure, the fact that those equations are wrong, occurs no matter how small the smallest radii become. You can send that Planck scale to zero and still. It's not like a little correction which gets bigger and bigger. It actually is just fundamentally wrong. And this failure, therefore, can have important phenomenological implications as you experimentally start measuring these things. Okay, that's the claim. I can show you in two transparencies that this is true. Well, how do you see things? You see things by looking and measuring Kaluza-Klein states. Here are the spectra. For a circle, it's just N1 over rho squared. For a two torus, well, here's the same formula I had before. I've just written it in a general form. N1 squared over R1 squared, N2 squared over R2 squared, mixing terms, sine squared in front. For a three torus, it's the same kind of stuff. Remember the angles, alpha 1, 2, alpha 1, 3, alpha 2, 3? S sub JK is the sine of the angle alpha JK. Cij is the cosine of the angle alpha. So these are just sines and cosines, okay? Still, N1 squared over R1 squared, N2 squared over R2 squared, N3 squared over R3 squared. Sine squared angles in front. There's an overall trigonometric factor, which is the volume of the parallelepiped. Then there are mixing terms, just like here. Okay, nothing fundamentally new. So, what happens? Suppose you have only the lightest amount of energy. Then you'll just see these modes. Now you have a little bit more energy. Well, sorry, let me say that differently. Suppose it's really a two torus, but I only have enough energy to see the first modes. So I don't have enough energy to excite N2. I only have enough energy to excite N1. So my energies are going to be given by N1 squared over R1 squared sine squared theta. But I won't know that it's a two torus. I'm going to interpret it this way. So what will happen is that I will identify the radius of my circle as being the radius that it looks like, namely sine theta times r, from only seeing the first excitation, the first tower on the two torus. Likewise, if I only have enough energy to see the first two dimensions here, out of the full three, I will identify the first N1 excitations as being fit to this formula, N2 excitations being fit to this formula, and the N1, N2 mixings, the shape part, to be fit by here, and I'm going to get some correspondence relations again. This is how you integrate out. But if you solve these equations, what you find is that they get very simple. This is it. So the two torus are related to the big three torus radii, but with angles. The cosine on the two torus is related to the cosines on the three torus, but in some non-trivial way. Likewise, if I pass to the one torus by integrating out yet a second extra dimension, I find that rho is not R1, but it's sine theta R1, and R1 is not capital R1, but except it's related by these factors. So these results reflect, especially these sine factors, the geometric shadows that successive smaller extra dimensions cast onto the larger extra dimensions when they're integrated out. And what they indicate geometrically is that the low-energy observer can only see those projections of the compactification space which are perpendicular to the extinguished extra dimensions. You only see what is perpendicular to what you've integrated out, regardless of how small what you integrated out was. And so the radii and shape moduli that you perceive at low energies are fake. They're not present at all in the original underlying geometry. So a small extra dimension, even no larger than the Planck length, is able to cast this huge shadow, just based on the trigonometric functions, over all the other length scales and their associated dimensions, completely distorting your low-energy perception of the underlying geometry. To make this very dramatic, here's one extra dimension. There's the other. And because of the presence of that one having an angle, you can't see this as being as big as it is. Because it shadowed it. All right, I'll give you one example. I'll give you several examples. Imagine the three torus has these real numbers. TeV, 10 to the 11, 10 to the 19. Imagine the base of the three torus is 90 degrees, rectangular. Imagine that the third extra dimension is now coming down. It's at 60 degrees from this, 60 degrees from that. So it's hanging up there. Okay, 90 degrees. Okay, what happens when I integrate out the third extra dimension, that little Planck scale? Well, now the two radii are not what they were before, but they appear to be a little bit bigger. But the angle on the base no longer looks 90 degrees. It looks like 71. You integrate out further to get down to TeV. You notice it's 1.225 TeV. All right, not a big numerical difference from one TeV, but it's persistent. Here's the spectrum. The first tower, the second tower, the third tower. And I'm saying that between TeV and 10 to the 11 GeV, that's 8 orders of magnitude, you are going to think you're on a circle. You're going to measure the KK spectrum. You're going to be absolutely certain the radius is 1.225 TeV. Suddenly you cross a threshold, you discover an extra dimension, you now refit to a two torus, and you realize you have been mistaken all along. But the extra dimension, the first biggest one, was actually 1.1155. You learn this, you know, 2 centuries later, if they fund the LHC, and the LC, and the VLHC. And then you think you're done now. Now you got it, 71 and everything. And now you're model building and you're playing games trying to understand this number 71. And you do that for several centuries with no success. Meanwhile, the experimentalists finally hit the Planck scale. And now you know it's a three torus. You go back again. And now you find it was exactly 1 TeV and 90 degrees, and you wasted all your time. These distortions are not large. These are not big differences, but they persist over many orders of magnitude, and they don't disappear even as the smallest dimensions are taken to zero. All right, that wasn't big. Here's something big. Here's a dramatic example. Let's imagine R1 equals R2, let's say millimeter, again 90 degrees. The other one is Planck scale, 10 to the 19. But imagine now that this extra dimension, this Planck scale, little tiny thing, dips really low. It's almost sitting in the plane of the other two. Angle 60 plus epsilon, 30 plus epsilon. If it were 60 and 30 exactly, it would be sitting on that plane. So let's imagine just a little bit up from the plane. What happens? It's just Planck scale, right? Shouldn't do anything. Okay, integrate it out. Now you get a ratio. Before they were equal, now there's a ratio. But look, the angle looks like a completely collapsed two torus. And it was 90 degrees. You just saw it wrong because of the distortion due to the Planck scale extra dimension. So the squashing of the original Planck-sized extra dimension relative to the large extra dimensions is perceived at low energies like a squashing of the two large dimensions with respect to each other. And notice, by the way, that an algebraic irrational with small angle was not really there. It appeared as a result of squashing, as a result of shadowing. Okay, here's another example. Three torus, again, millimeter and millimeter, Planck, 90 degrees, but now I dip almost in the direction of one of the directions. Well, that induces a two torus where you appear to have a huge hierarchy of radii. One could be millimeter and one could be TeV. And you'd say, how the heck did I get this hierarchy? You didn't. It wasn't really there. It was a result of angles, not radii. Okay, it even works in reverse. Again, millimeter, millimeter, TeV. Now imagine 60 degrees instead of 90 and 45, nothing squashed. Well, when you integrate that out, it looks like the base is now rectangular. So even if you don't measure non-trivial shape, you actually could have measured it. Trivial shape could be a low-energy illusion produced by shadowing when you really do have non-trivial shape. All right, I'm almost done. How do you interpret this? Well, what this means is that as you go to higher and higher energies and discover additional space-time dimensions, your description of the manifold changes. Your perception of quantities such as radii and shape associated with the largest extra dimensions continually evolves as a function of the energy with which you probe the manifold. Even though you already discovered the extra dimensions, the largest ones, 2 centuries ago, and their properties have been known for 2 centuries and printed in the particle properties data book. Therefore, the apparent compactification geometry is not fixed at all, but instead it actually undergoes renormalization, much like other constants of nature. Now, some people may quibble, but think about it. You have a different series of effective field theories at each energy scale. As you cross the energy thresholds, your effective theory changes, 2 torus, 3 torus, so forth. These correspondence relations are matching conditions or threshold effects, which describe the same physics at different energy scales. These relations, these correspondence relations, emerge from the requirement that the physical KK spectrum remain invariant. The physics is invariant under the change in the effective field theories with different cutoffs. That's renormalization. And if you imagine extrapolating these calculations to incorporate a series of extra dimensions, a continuing series of hierarchies, then this is essentially a corresponding renormalization group flow. Okay, I'm done. Let me just say that this is triggered entirely by non-trivial shape moduli. It's purely classical effect. It's just the properties of geometry. I'm not talking about quantum effects, although those can also be included. As an experimental question, there's always possibly a smaller extra dimension that you still haven't found. You never know what the totality is as an experimental question. So there's no such thing in this sense as a true compactification geometry, just like there's no true charge. All right, this is very provocative. What happens in curved space, warped space? Might our own four-dimensional space-time only appear to be large and flat as a consequence of shadowing from additional space-time dimensions? If so, is this a possible new approach to the cosmological constant problem? You could even ask a philosophical question. In what sense is space-time geometry knowable at all? What properties can be known with certainty? What are the renormalization group invariants? Okay, and then you can say things like deconstruct and blah, blah, blah. Deconstruction goes along with prayer. Here's a joke. If you think that extra dimensions have no practical purpose, wrong. There's something called a prayer amplifier, which transforms the heartfelt positive desires of prayer into electromagnetic frequencies, which are then directed into the 6 theoretical non-physical dimensions of the universe. Huh? How much is it? I'll buy it and sell it to you. Okay, I have one more transparency. More recently, last month, we put out a paper showing that shape moduli also affect winding modes. Ordinarily, there are KK modes whose masses are inverse with R and windings which are proportional. If the string scale is here, the KK modes are lighter, they start lighter, then the winding modes start heavier. So either way, you will either see below the string scale either KK modes or winding modes, one or the other based on a T-dual description. So you would say that up to the string scale, you must see evidence of space-time compactification, because you will either see the KK tower below or the winding tower below. However, with non-trivial shape moduli and torsion fields, BMU-nu fields, we showed that it is possible to have the KK towers start above the string scale and the winding towers start above the string scale. They're still T-dual to each other, but they are both heavier than the string scale. So the string oscillator modes can sometimes be the lowest states that you see, and they would dominate the light phenomenology. Not KK, not winding. So it might be possible to probe the string structure before you ever probe the compactification geometry. Finally, this really is the last transparency. We didn't use supersymmetry. Is there supersymmetry in the desert? The answer is yes. I am shamelessly advertising now. SUSY 2003 will be in Tucson, Arizona. That's where it is, about 2,000 miles south of here, late May and early June. And I hope to see you all there. So thank you. What are we talking about?
Torus to the supersymmetric torus. Okay.
What do you mean the supersymmetric torus?
If we question the super Riemannian surface, the Jesus one super Riemannian surface, super torus.
Okay.
So
you're doing a torus on superspace.
Yeah.
Gosh. Okay. Already I know nothing, so I can tell you that right now. But continue. Maybe somebody else will answer your question. Go ahead. I don't know.
Yeah. What happens if you take, in that case, you have two same modulus. One bosonic half,
yeah,
and the other is perimetric delta modulus.
Yeah.
So I want to know the mass dependence, the perimetric modulus one.
I don't know. I've never even thought about it. It would be interesting. I don't know. Well done.
Are the copies of the taking ones changing?
They don't violate universality, if you're worried about that. I don't see why, a priori.
So if you're above the first state, you know, you have two towers that start at different masses.
Yeah.
If you're above the first one, I would do the integrals more better.
I don't think so, because I think the couplings, all of those factors are dependent on the volume moduli, but not the shape moduli. The shape moduli just come into the KK expansion, the resonant frequencies on this thing. I mean, it's remarkable if you think about it that a Planck scale extra dimension dipped in some way could affect how you see that, but the problem is putting it there and dipping it, even though it's small, compresses the resonances on this little space, this very narrow space, and forces you not to see the resonances that you would have seen if you had just had a one-dimension thing. It's just a question of how the shape moduli actually compress the resonances, and I don't think it's going to affect the couplings. The couplings are how the full higher-dimensional field couples in the higher-dimensional theory. And in the higher-dimensional theory, you don't know anything about the shape, only the volume.
So I have a comment here. So it seems to me that the really physical parameters are like KK masses and not the sizes of the expansion. So
that's true.
Comments that we will discover those KK masses and we will know actually nothing about the underlying geometry. I take that with a grain of salt in the sense that I think it's really crucial to learn what are the KK masses.
Oh yeah.
And then fit to some.
Yeah, it may not bother you. I'm not saying anything as an experiment. Right, sure, right. But I'm saying up until now we have a tendency. You can view everything I said here as indicating that that the words radii are bad. And we should simply be talking about masses and spectra of the states. But there is going to be a tendency, sociologically, to take those KK states and say, we now understand the compactification manifold.
But that's an effective compactification, which is good to know anyways.
Yeah, but I'm telling you that those words are wrong. And that's an important thing.
Just effective, but it's up to a certain scale.
Yeah, sure, fine. Well, that's what I said. It's something that gets renormalized. You would have viewed the radius of an extra dimension as something being fixed and handed down from the beginning. No. It's something like electron charge. You know, what energy did you measure it at? What did you mean when you said it? And so forth.
Can I make one?
Sure.
So, also, long ago, the mathematicians asked the question, can one hear the shape of the drum?
Which means
that supposed that you exactly know the spectrum of some operators on many modes. The question is that
this is the paper. This is the paper I posted. Let me read the final paragraph. There is an old question in mathematical physics. Can one hear the shape of a drum? Clearly, our answer is that drums have no absolute shape. Instead, the shape of a drum depends on how well one listens. Thank you for the question. Yes, and the check is in the mail.
Even if you know the spectrum completely, you cannot.
That's right. Geometry is not knowable this way.
You have that last picture where you have the KK and the winding mode heavier than string.
Yeah.
Do you think that somehow you might be able to see effectively a real four-dimensional string theory?
Perhaps over a... Good question. If all the extra dimensions were near their self-dual radii, and I'm claiming that those self-dual radii are such that all the KK and winding masses are heavier. Yeah, and suppose they're all like this, so I arrange it like this.
Yes,
probably. But there is a limit, a fundamental limit, as to how high you can push this. I cannot separate the bottom of the KK tower and the bottom of the winding tower by arbitrary amounts from the string scale. There is a geometric limit. But I can do it for order of magnitude. Well, I don't even know order of magnitude. I can do it certainly for factors of 2, 3, 4. But I don't think I can do it for a factor of 100 or anything.
Is it limited by number A?
Sorry? No, it's not related to A at all. This is a completely different thing. It's related to how much anti-symmetric B field I have and what my angles are. There are exact equations in the paper. It just depends on the angles, and also something that goes with angles called an anti-symmetric B field. Basically, if you want to think about angles as shape angles as mixing different KK directions, there's an analogous thing which mixes KKs with winding directions, so to speak, and that's called an anti-symmetric B field, torsion. So it's like shape for KKs and windings, and they all come together. Yeah, sure. Well, if you think about it, these tori are... the Narain construction exactly in fact, the Narain construction is even more interesting. I mean, I talked about it at Aspen, but all right, I'll make one comment. In string theory, you know, it's not just the mass of a state is not just given by KK and winding contributions. There's also oscillator contributions and vacuum energies. And this is important because vacuum energies are negative. So therefore, the lightest states in string theory are not necessarily the ones with zero KK and winding numbers. Very often, it's the multiply excited KK and winding states which are the lightest ones in string theory. And proof of this is the Narain construction. If you think about how that works, you toroidally compactify a string theory on some lattice, some torus, and the KK and winding, non-trivial KK winding states are themselves the ones that give rise to the gauge bosons. So massless states, the gluon itself could be a KK and winding state simultaneously. So the lightest states are not always the ones with no KKs and windings. So it's really a lot more complicated in the full context of string theory. We discussed this in this paper as well because it comes in. Yeah.
So you have two extra dimensions, and then you have the Planck scale.
Yeah.
Very low, close to the.
Yeah, really collapses onto the base. Yeah. Yeah, you think they're 90. They are truly 90 degrees, and yet you see them as being almost.
Yeah. So since you have six extra dimensions to play with, so how natural is our four dimension? Can you arrange a scenario such that we don't have our four?
I'll tell you something. One could do all that, and I don't know what the answer is because I ran out of pens. I used to sit on my desk with different pens, and I would try to imagine these things. And after three dimensions, I ran out of... I couldn't picture it anymore. But you can algebraically go through the process. The question is, if we think we're living in a four-dimensional, uncompactified space with, you know, no shape... And by the way, there was a paper just a few days ago that appeared on Astro something asking if the world, you know, if the universe, what is the topology of the universe, what is the shape? And they're looking at the CMB spectrum to fit, you know... It's true. But, you know, we think we live on a certain space, but we don't know that our perception of it isn't shadowed by additional Planck scales. I mean, that could be one way of thinking about the cosmological constant problem. The universe looks flat, but, it's a different kind of thing, but...
It seems like one extra small dimension, which is tilted onto the plane would kill one dimension, physical dimension. Is it the right concept?
I don't think it works so simply. What happens is that extreme shape in angles tends to give rise to extreme shapes somewhere else when you integrate it out. Either extreme ratios of radii or extreme angles on bases that remain. So extremeness in shape kind of propagates down, but it comes in different places as you go. I haven't studied it systematically to say in general what happens. Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
So you don't think that the shape might not be coordinated?
We checked. We haven't written it up yet. We have a draft. As far as couplings are concerned, because it's basically masses and couplings, and there is no way from couplings to deduce that you're being shadowed. So couplings shadow as well. There's no way to know. And notice, nothing I'm ever saying is a way by which you could learn that there was an extra dimension beyond your energy scale. You always see a self-consistent picture with the right number of extra dimensions. You're just seeing it all wrong. And the same thing happens for couplings. Yeah, I didn't talk about that, but it's also
so
true.
What's the right thing to think about?
Masses of KK modes. No, that's it. Those are the only true physical observables. You could ask another question. Maybe this is a modular effect. Maybe I could do modular transformations on the radii to unshadow again. Can't. It's important to show that, otherwise this is meaningless. And the point is, these are not movements within the same. If you bring everything back to the same modular slice, I don't want to get into this, but if you bring everything back to the same modular slice, you still find that there was a non-trivial effect. So this is really physical.
No more questions? Let's thank you.